Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering chapters 3 and 4 of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, The Burrow and Flourish and Blots. In these chapters, Harry escapes from his familial prison, and there's a scuffle between grown-ass men in a bookstore.
Sorry. That was a bit surprising. Oh my.
Exactly. But what did you think of these two chapters overall?
Well, I was very grateful that, and if you follow our Instagram account, the Rambling Ravenpuffs, I've been trying to post after I read the chapters or before them, just to kind of speculate on my own. I'm very grateful we are now at the Weasleys. We are no longer at Privet Drive, and there was mention of spiders, and I know that's a thing that's going to happen in this book, and I'm not thrilled about it, but I'll be okay. So. And I'm sorry, I already forgot the name of the Nocturne Alley. That was a surprise. That was a pretty interesting and more like occulty version of
this witchcraft world.
Yeah, which is kind of cool because I feel like I've read a lot about some of those things and the beliefs that people have about witchcraft and things like that kind of fall into Nocturne Alley more over Diagon Alley, but. Anyway, how was your reread of these two chapters?
I really enjoyed the heist bits of chapter 3 more so than I have in rereadings past.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, that's
interesting. It's just the idea of Ron comes to save Harry, but he's not alone. He's got his twin brothers, the mischievous ones, Fred and George. And what I forgot about is what prompts Ron into action to come get Harry in the flying car is that it was a combination of not hearing from Harry and then hearing from his dad from work that Harry's been given a warning for using, magic as an underage wizard.
Right, yeah. And it wasn't, and, you know, of course, we all know it wasn't Harry's fault, but they, you know, they don't know that.
Yeah, and Ron knows Harry, and Ron knows that Harry would not be stupid enough to do that, again, unless he was in a really dire or not great situation.
Right. Yeah. I'd love the dad's reaction to some of this. I know we're not that far yet, but thankfully, let's just say it right now, Harry didn't starve to death because that is the direction he was headed at the Dursleys.
Yes, he was. And then, so at first, Harry is actually kind of the logical one, or at least the least rash one or presumptive one, where he's like, you gotta tell the people at Hogwarts I'm trapped here. And they're just like, screw that. We're breaking the bars right now.
I know. Yeah. They were not messing around, which totally fine. I mean, honestly, the neighborhood should have seen the bars on the window and been like, what is going on there? But I'm glad the Weasleys came.
And so, yeah, they literally have a rope, tie it to the bars, rip the bars off the window. No one wakes up,
which is a little peculiar. Yes.
Yeah,
but you can kind of hear Uncle Vernon, you know, in the, I think he's like making noise and coughing. That's what he's doing, because they also have to go through the house to get Harry's things, which are locked and covered.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, because Fred and George, you know, they are 2 years older than Ron, but they can't use magic. Technically, they're underage as well, but they use the old school, like, hairpin trick.
Yeah, a little bit of not relying on magic. They're kind of forced to do that, which is, I kind of like that rule in this so far, is that they do have to kind of rely on some muggle, I don't know, expertise to get Harry out of this situation, which we all know they could have easily magicked their way out of it, but they didn't do that because they didn't want to get.
Yeah. And as Morgan was putting out this whole thing of magic has made some sects of wizarding society a little sissy, or at least a little lazy in not trying to, you know, think about what if I was in a position where I didn't have my wand and I couldn't use magic, what could I do?
Right. Yeah. So they kind of have to rely on some of the more human elements of.
Yeah. They need to have a game show just of wizards and like Survivor on trapped on an island and no wands, no magic.
Oh man, that would be like a wizard Survivor. That would be pretty interesting.
Indeed. So, but yeah, so Fred and George go and get Harry's stuff. They drag it into the car. And again, hashtag save Hedwig. Harry's about to forget Hedwig.
Oh, how could you forget Hedwig, the beautiful snowy owl? Like, come on.
And why does Hedwig wake Vernon up but not the bars being ripped off the window?
I mean, that is logic that I cannot figure out, other than maybe he's like tuned to high pitched noises.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is him honing in on because he's been so fed up with Hedwig.
Maybe. I mean, like, my husband sleeps through a lot, and he doesn't particularly like owls, so maybe that would, maybe I should test it on him. I don't know if he'd still hear, like, sleep through bars being torn off the windows, but you never know.
Mm-hmm. He's like, oh crap, I forgot Hedwig. Goes to get Hedwig, and, you know, this has been what has woken Vernon up. You know, goes to the door and is like, Petunia, he's escaping. And again, the specific nature of the Dursleys' abuse, just let him go. You hate him anyway.
I know, like that's kind of surprised me. Why does he care? Why isn't he like, just like, good riddance? Is there some sort of like penalty hanging over him that, I mean, Harry's parents are no longer living. So I guess, does he think, I don't know. That kind of baffled me a little bit.
Yeah, again, not that it's described very much in the books, but I wonder from their position, are they scared that he will escape, tell the wizard child services they locked me up and get more trouble?
Maybe. A legitimate fear coming from somebody like him who is, or somebody like Petunia and Uncle Vernon who were not the nicest people. So
they finally drive away into the moonlight with Harry screaming, see you next summer.
We haven't talked about the flying car. I mean, we talk a lot about the flying car here in a little bit, but like,
yeah, what I wanted the flying car.
Well, I kind of wondered how that worked. You know, was it like, was there an invisibility spell put over the car? Because it's not a small thing to be flying up to somebody's window.
I think there's a mention in a later chapter that there's an invisibility booster.
Okay. Then that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, technically it's a Ford Anglia.
Oh, I don't know anything about cars, but...
Yeah, neither do I. But basically, Harry naturally interprets, like, you're doing magic too right now. And he's like, but this isn't us waving our wands. This is our dad who enchanted this car already.
So they're like, let's not get ourselves in trouble. Let's take it to another level and get our father in trouble. That's not really... I mean... We kind of deal with some of that here later in the chapter with his magicking things. But yeah, interesting choice from the Weasleys.
I think the only other thing they could have done was broomsticks.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because broomsticks are already enchanted, so that's not them doing quote-unquote magic themselves. Like, that's the only other way they could have gotten there.
Okay. Well, I'm glad they got him out either way. And then I think this kind of leads them to the discussion of how he got out and that he did some magic to, you know, kind of throw up the warning, which then Harry's like, no, it wasn't. And it wasn't me. And then he talks to them about Dobby and the warning that she gave, or he gave Harry. And, you know, the Weasley brothers are kind of like, it's kind of interesting, but the house elves don't, they have powerful magic, but they can't usually use it without their masters. So yes.
It begs the question of, is Dobby in a position magically to defy his master in such a way, albeit indirectly, by going to Harry? Or is it more likely that Dobby was sent as a sort of joke at the behest of his master?
Yeah, that's a pretty, I mean, and they blame Malfoy for this, obviously. That's, I don't know. That's a pretty random joke. Also, if, you know, I don't, not random, but that's just pretty, I don't know. I thought about that when they like kind of posed that question. I don't really think it was a joke, so, but I don't know.
Yeah, because, and again, it's sort of weird to send a house elf, because again, we understand in this context that house elves are only, like, you know, servants in very, you know, to very prominent families, wizarding families, in, like, castles and manors and stuff like that. So you're already depleting the pool of suspects by sending a house elf.
That's a good point. Yeah. So that kind of would have to be a wealthy family. Obviously, it wouldn't be her because she lives with nonnes.
But yeah, but it's not even like a middle class thing where you have like the help or whatever. This is like really like only the super old. I don't know, what's the opposite of nouveau-riche? Like the old school money.
The old money. Yeah,
this, the old money has this sort of servant in their service.
How strange. I also think it's really strange how the house elves are portrayed, because they're not, I would think of it like as a butler or something like that, and kind of more put together. And I don't remember what Dobby was wearing, but I know there's something with a sock. I don't know if he was wearing a sock. I know if he gets a sock, he gets freedom or something like that. Again, this is my like loose knowledge of the things I know.
Well, Dobby was wearing a ragged like pillowcase. And then you bring up an excellent point that you would think that you would want, you know, what it's like, what do you prioritize? The appearance of, yes, this servant is lower than us, but to a certain extent, he represents our family in some capacity. But in this context, in this world, it's all about the superiority of, we are going to crush you and humiliate you and you have to be dirty and everything like that.
I think that's unfortunate just for us, the aesthetic purposes. Like I would prefer like to take care of, But again, I guess I'm not an asshole that has an elf servant. But like, anyway.
I'm just trying to think of Dobby as a butler. May I take your coat, sir?
I kind of love that. I think he would feel better with about the monocle. Himself. Yes. Adorable. That's the artwork I want to see.
Yes. So again, their immediate suspicion is, who fits the description of being old money, who would possibly have a house elf, who has a grudge against Harry? Who else? The Malfoys.
Draco. Yep.
Ugh. Yes, so they throw that around, and then they finally head home, and they try to say, like, okay, we're going to park the car, we're going to go back to bed, and we're going to tell Mom that Harry just showed up at the door.
Yeah, and much like my going out when I lived at home, Mom is there and awake and knows, you know, exactly what's going on.
Yeah, so I was just thinking, like, how do they think, like, how did Harry get halfway across the country to Ottery St. Catchpole, where they live?
I don't know. I didn't even think about that. I was just like, that we're flying, we're leaving the Dursleys. I think maybe I was just so grateful that I didn't have to hear about them for another chapter, that I got lost in the flying.
Yeah,
the
but flight. Again, yeah, they didn't really think this through, or they could have said, the only thing they could have said was Harry, like, showed up on his broomstick. That's the only thing that could have possibly worked.
That could have worked. Would he have been in trouble by the ministry again? Would that be, like, a second use of magic? Bless you.
Yeah, excuse me. Right, just riding a broomstick? No, because that's already been enchanted. It seems to be that the ministry can only detect wand magic, or like when it comes to wizards, or like if it's a magical object that's using its magical properties, like that's, you know, the person using it is not blamed, or at least is not detected in that way. So only a broomstick could have worked.
Got it. Well, so I guess we're talking about the Weasleys were at their house, and then we're talking about all the things that his father, Ron's father, I don't remember his name right now, just call him Father Weasley.
Arthur Weasley.
Arthur, okay. Is part of the Ministry of Magic that deals with enchanted muggle items, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
The Office of Improper, like, Magical Artifacts or something like that.
Okay. And he's like, they're raiding places for these things, but he's also hoarding them, including an enchanted car.
Yeah. So basically, he's made it in the law so that, you know, you can't go around like muggle baiting or causing problems for muggles. But technically, it is not illegal to enchant them itself. It's just if you use them for malicious purposes or, you know, purposes like that threaten the secrecy of their society, then that gets you in trouble.
I kind of liked the way they kind of explained away a tea set, you know, to this woman, and it was it would like spray boiling water on people all over the place. And one man ended up with in the hospital with sugar tongs clamped to his nose, because it makes me think of like haunted dolls and stuff like that. It's kind of a little way to be like, yeah, those things are just really enchanted items that have made their way to the muggle world. I thought that was kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. And yeah, when they mentioned this, gave a few like descriptions, I thought there was going to be like a temperamental gravy pot. Maybe that's somewhere else in this series, but yeah, I was just thinking, maybe I'm just confusing that with the enchanted Beauty and the Beast castle.
I don't know.
Yeah. But I feel so bad for Molly that clearly the dynamic in their family and her relationship with her husband is definitely, she is the one that ends up being bad cop all the time.
Yeah, yes, she is. Because of this kind of affinity for and curiosity that Arthur has for muggle things. And then also, I mean, she has Jenny, right? That's the only girl.
Yeah, the seventh child, Jenny, she's the only girl.
Yeah, so it's very male-dominated atmosphere that she lives in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are some who have suggested that, you know, just the fact that the Weasleys have red hair and have a lot of children, then that's playing into certain, like, Irish and Scottish stereotypes.
I thought about that. I just thought that was kind of interesting way to, I was wondering, like, why do they have so many kids? Like, that just kind of was interesting. So I would say that the stereotyping, and maybe I just am reading past it, wasn't in my face as much as some other things have been, but I could see where that comes from for sure.
Yeah. Well, the stereotype of, you know, the Irish having lots of kids, that stems from the fact that the majority of Irish are Catholic, and technically within the Catholic doctrine, you know, they frown upon contraception because they feel that it interferes with, you know, what God intends.
Yeah. Yes. As a Catholic school girl, I know about that, but the Irish Catholic plenty of kids thing, I guess they really take that stereotypically. I feel like I'm spiraling, so I'm going to stop talking. But their house sounds cute. I don't know. I love Harry's reaction to it, because Ron is obviously very self-conscious about his house, and that, you know, they talk about it kind of being magicked together a little bit, the extra rooms and something that we had talked about before was Harry's, like, how big the Dursleys' house was. And I had always imagined Harry in a much smaller room, but there's mention of his room at the Dursleys' here. Anyway, so Harry is, you know, Ron's being self-conscious and he's just like, this is great. I love this. And I thought that was kind of nice.
And, you know, just reading this made me think about, you know, where I live now was my first house buying experience.
Oh, okay.
And there's nothing that really puts whatever socioeconomic insecurities you had as house hunting.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true.
For Ron, he's sort of subconscious that, you know, he knows that there are lots of better wizarding houses, or even compares, again, the Dursley's house as being better or more spacious. But Harry just is so enamored by the homeliness of it and just how comforting it is. And that's kind of how I feel about my little lake country condo that I currently live in. Again, it's, you know, it's barely, you know, 1,000, you know, square footage, but it's just so cute. And we puttered it up and has a cute spiral staircase to the loft and has so much character. And even though it's not, you know, the most lavish, we still love it.
I think that's, I mean, yeah, I think that in, you know, in Harry Potter's world, he, or in his mind, I feel like it's kind of very a feeling of home and warmth and things that he definitely did not feel at the Dursleys, which so I'm like having this view of the Dursleys' house that I kind of suspected one way. And now it's very much like much kind of museum like, which is not how I first thought about it. But yeah, I think the nice coziness of the house, I liked it. My house is the same and I'm very happy about it. So I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah. And then so the boys try to be like, oh, we're so tired, we're going to go to bed. And Molly's just like, screw that. It's your own damn fault that you were up all night. You get to go denome the garden.
I thought that was pretty funny. She's like, nope, you're not sleeping. You have to go do this. And I was like, well, that's pretty fair. And then we get introduced to another character here, Mr. Gilroy Lockhart.
Yeah, in reference to denoming the garden, apparently he's written a book about, you know, just household affairs.
Right. And they're like, we're fine. And she's like, fine. If you know better than Mr. Lockhart, then power to you. Go figure it out. I thought that was good.
Yeah. So what do you think of the gnomes?
I'm just disappointed that they aren't like garden gnomes that we have, because I think those are funny. And these guys are very not funny. They're kind of a pain in the ass and they're kind of sneaky. So I guess they're kind of funny still, but they sound like, I'm glad I don't have any in my garden right now.
I had forgotten that they could talk, so that they're intelligent enough for speech.
You know, so something that made me laugh is like they spin them around, right? They like spin them around and then throw them out over the gate. And yeah. It's like, oh, it doesn't hurt them. It just makes them dizzy. It's like, you don't know this. I feel like people treat animals like that sometimes, which bothers me. But that's kind of what I thought there. It's like, they're fine. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah,
them.
Like I would question, again, how okay they are. And even just the way they treat them, you know, one of them's like, oh, they'll be back. Dad is really soft on them. He thinks they're funny. And that kind of reminded me of my own relationship with my neighborhood raccoons.
Mm-hmm.
Some people really don't like them, like call them trash pandas. Well, I call them trash pandas too, but in an affectionate way. And, you know.
Right.
And, you know, leave them scraps from time to time. But yeah, they just keep coming back. And even like, I'll be like dealing with the trash or whatever. And, you know, it's now at the point where I'm saying shoo or being there. It doesn't faze him anymore. He's just like grabbing my hand. Feed me, mommy. Feed me.
That's okay. Hey, that's okay. I think they're cute. As long as they don't like get out of control.
The only problem is sometimes, you know, I'll be cleaning and want to like sweep the floor or something. And so I'll take a knotted like trash bag and leave it, you know, outside near the door ready to like go out to the dumpster. But then I won't end up going to the dumpster that day. And then when I open the door, like the trash bag will be totally ripped because they were.
Yeah, I've had that experience before, too.
Today was one of those days. And especially because we just bought these random like stuffed clams, like frozen stuffed clams, to see if they were any good. FYI, they weren't. But anyway, the point was we had all these like clams and they went through and all 9 clams picked them apart for every little morsel.
Oh my goodness. That's so funny that they can sniff that out.
Oh yeah.
We have quite the wildlife show. We have a fox that's running around cute, but I don't know what is going on.
Is he bright red?
I think, you know, we've only seen it on our ring at night, but he looks like he is, and he has little black socks. So, but that we've had the same thing happen with the trash. That's why I get up at the crack of dawn to take the trash out so the critters know. So,
yeah, like we saw foxes in earlier years when we moved here. We haven't seen a fox in a good 2 years, and they were always so cute because they're the bright red with white underbelly, like the typical image when you think of a fox, because all the foxes in Oregon are gray and yucky looking.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, but here, they're the cutesy red ones, but we haven't seen them in a while.
Come on, get on with the red foxes. That's,
yeah. Anyway, gnomes, raccoons, and foxes aside.
All outdoor critters.
All pests aside, Arthur Weasley comes home and he's like, 9 raids, 9. An old Mundungus Fletcher tried to put a hex on me while I had my back turned. We will actually meet Mundungus Fletcher in book 5.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's funny that you say that, because it was just like a name I probably just read past. I was just like, okay.
Yeah, that's the thing that I like what Harry the writer does in this book. Like, he will throw away a name or throw away something, and it, like, 3 to 4 books later, it comes back.
I like that, too.
Yep, and so Molly's just like, your son flew that car to Surrey and back last night. And Arthur's like, did you really? Did it work? How did it go? I mean, that was very wrong, boys. Very wrong of you.
Right. I loved that his reaction. It was just like, oh my gosh, how cool. Oh, no, you shouldn't have done that. Like, that's horrible. That was a pretty cute reaction to have. I kind of get, I guess, based on just how the kids act, you kind of don't think Arthur's going to be that much of a hard ass. At least that was kind of my thought initially. But yeah, it was a cute reaction.
Yep. And then in this, we also meet Ginny, the youngest of the Weasleys. Well, we met her very briefly on the platform in the last book. But she's here now, and they're commenting on, like, apparently she's really fascinated or whatever, or awestruck by Harry, and to the point that, you know, she barely speaks in his presence. And Ron's like, you don't know how weird it is for her to be this shy. She never shuts up normally.
Yeah, I just felt bad for her being, like, a young girl that's, like, intimidated by her brother's friends. I mean, that's just kind of how I related to her. Like I said, I think I've said before, I was pretty shy growing up. So, and then I didn't have like some wizard celebrity coming over to my house. It was like my brother's dorky friends. So I can only imagine. I really feel bad for Ginny here.
I'm always fascinated by the notion of, you know, the dynamics amongst more than two siblings and having brothers, because I've had neither. I only have one sibling and it's only one older sister. I've never had the dynamic of having brothers younger or older.
Well, I was surrounded by boys growing up. So I have one sibling who's my younger brother, but my extended family were all boys. So I think that explains some of my personality sometimes. I don't know. Yeah, but so I feel bad for Ginny. She's surrounded by all these boys, this boy that she's kind of enamored with. And I mean, comes and is staying at her house, and he's trying to be really nice to her, and she's just very, very shy. So poor Ginny.
Yep, and it's just the idea that she can't even have the peace of being like a quote unquote normal girl, again, with both elements of masculine and feminine, because she's just surrounded by all these boys and has to constantly assert herself in a masculine way.
Right. Yeah, testosterone. And the color orange. So I wanted to talk about this really quickly because we talk about their red. They all have red hair. And then Ron's room is basically orange. And I was trying to think about this related to like the chakras in yoga because of the orange. And I couldn't really make a great connection. It deals mainly with like pleasure and creativity and things like that.
Yeah, isn't that the throat chakra?
The throat chakra is blue. It's sacral. Blue.
Oh, chakra. Yeah, because it goes from the bottom up. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, red's the root. So I was trying to think, like, I don't think there's any sort of chakra thing here, but the emphasis on orange just kind of made me, like, I wonder if there's any more.
Yeah, well, it seems that the orange is, you know, he's turned his shrine into his favorite Quidditch team, which is the Chudley Cannons, and it appears that their colors are orange.
I just thought that was interesting, like, why was that the choice, you know, that was made? But again, I guess reading this as Harry, so it was just the team color. So I get it. My brother was a Dallas Cowboys fan. His room was blue and silver. So,
yep. And then again, we go into, you know, it's small, like it's not much. But Harry's like, this is the best house I've ever been in. Ron's ears went pink.
I loved that so much because especially with Malfoy, you know, we meet Dick Malfoy, who's going to make some comment about money here in the next chapter. I mean, at least he knows his like buddy Harry's got his back.
Yeah. And then there's also the sense of not being poor, like just in wizarding society as a whole. I think it's the extra implication that they adhere to pure blood supremacy values, but they are an anomaly in being a completely pure blood family, the Weasleys, and not having the sort of status or money that is typically found in pure blood families like Malfoy's.
Is that ever explained? Because I kind of was curious about that as well.
It's implied in some chapters of what possibly could be that reason, but we'll get into it later.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Just curious.
Chapter 4, At Flourish and Blot. What Harry found most unusual about life at Ron's, however, wasn't the talking mirror or the clanking ghoul. It was, in fact, that everyone there seemed to like him.
I thought that was nice. And I also think that they'd say that they liked each other. Also, I would like to have a mirror that told me what was up so I don't want the house looking like a...
I love those mirrors because, you know, we see these mirrors throughout this series. And it isn't like saying, oh, you're ugly, like, you know, commenting on, like, your actual... like things within your physical appearance you can't change. It's just like, tuck in your shirt, Scruffy.
I mean, that's what I need somebody to be like, hey, maybe iron that once if you're gonna leave the house. So I would appreciate
it. Or like a daily mantra.
Right. Like, it's all gonna be okay. That's what I need. So yeah, their life is, it's pretty homey and friendly. And then, I mean, and then we have Jenny, who is very nervous around Harry, which we talked a little bit about too. And they get some letters from school in this book list with, like, is it 5 books from Gilderoy Lockhart?
It's 7.
Oh my gosh. Okay, it's 7.
It's 7 books, and it's not even separated by year. So the fact that all the kids need these books regardless of what year they're in, what, like, level, that leads the twins to conclude that this must be what's required of the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, because in terms of staffing, nothing else has changed as far as we know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and then it also made me, I didn't, okay, without knowing what we will find out soon, I kind of was like, what, like, publisher made a deal with this school that was like, you got to get this author's books only? We find out the reason later, but I thought that was quite odd. Read that in it.
Yeah, you know, just wasn't thinking about this reading it, but just now thinking about how the dynamic of buying textbooks, how it evolved from when I was an undergrad till now.
Oh, tell me, because I haven't been in school for a long time.
At Syracuse University, where I did my undergraduate, it was pretty much, it was kind of on the professor's responsibility to make sure that the university bookstore had the book in stock for the students.
Oh, wow.
Like, you know, so it was very much like that. And you had, and again, there were lots of books you had to buy. And then as it progressed throughout the years, both graduate and undergraduate, professors and I think a lot of people started to realize just the sheer, you know, how expensive a lot of these super academic books is. And so lately, a lot of professors are getting better at, you know, just creating PDFs of the chapters needed and not creating a huge financial burden on students. I feel like that's something that has changed for the better.
That's excellent, because that was, I mean, goodness, especially I'm thinking about being like a literary arts person and on my master's, like the stacks of books that I had to buy, it was like out of control. Now, granted, it wasn't a textbook that was like hundreds of dollars. I mean, I did that in my undergrad, but it was just like, oh my God. The only thing that I noticed that had changed was kind of like the availability of books to rent rather than to buy. I always like to buy mine. I don't know why. And then sell them and get $2.
You like to have your own book. You don't want there to be a timeline. Again, which is why I have trouble using libraries more often, because when I want a book and I want to read it, I just want it now to have it whenever I want it.
I 100%. 100%.
Yeah. Well, and then another thing was, before they got into big PDFs, like again, when I first started grad school, in, what was it, 2013, again, I just moved from, like, Syracuse, like, a private middle-sized university, to Indiana University, a very big public one. And, you know, again, I was so used to just this culture that it's the professor's responsibility to make sure that the book is at the university store. And so there was several books for my chronic studies class that I could not find, and I emailed the professor as much. And the professor just sent a reply very sarcastically, and that's why God created Amazon.
What?
Again, he wasn't a bad professor or anything. You know, he's actually, he's my husband's advisor for his dissertation now.
Oh, wow.
So, I wasn't like necessarily offended by that by any stretch of the imagination. I was just surprised by the culture. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to come off as spoiled. This is just how it was before.
At least you didn't have like a Gilderoy Lockhart. I don't know. I did have one professor assign like his own book, and I just always just kind of like, okay, I don't know.
My husband had a class where the readings were all the own professors. I hate that.
There is a vibe that I am not a fan of that I got. It's just like, okay.
If you have 6 books you want your students to buy for your class, maximum 2 of them should be your own. Like, it shouldn't exceed 1/3 of the reading list.
No. But I bet, like, I bet Mrs. Weasley, though she, you know, the price is obviously an issue that they're concerned about, which made me think about something. And I'm sure it's kind of like part of you kind of says, like, why doesn't Harry just say, like, go, I'll take care of it. And I mean, I know there's some things about you don't want to invite that necessarily. But I also bet Mrs. Weasley was like, that's pretty cool, Gilderoy Lockhart, because she seems to be kind of sweet.
A little bit. So they get to the point where they get a letter from Hermione. And they decide, okay, we can go to Diagon Alley at the same time that Hermione does. And so they decide to travel to Diagon Alley via flu powder. What do you think of flu powder?
I think that God knows where I would end up with the way I talk and how, like, Google recognizes my voice sometimes. So I don't know. Probably would have ended up in a weird spot. Kind of cool. Kind of scary. It would not be my preferred way to travel either. So
I'm just thinking about the evolution of it. Just thinking that I think it's natural that of various forms of traveling. Again, you have broomsticks and stuff like that. But again, that's in the outside world that muggles could potentially see. Like, to me, from this, you know, they've been living in secrecy for like centuries. And so it's natural that this is a type of transportation that was developed and that they invested in to perfect, because it means you don't have to go outside your house to travel and cause attention for the muggles.
Yeah, that's a good point. It also always reminds me of Game of Thrones. There's a specific kind of fire. I forgot what it's called.
Oh, the green wildfire.
Yes, that's what it made me think.
You know what? I just finished Clash of Kings and I just finished Battle of Blackwater Bay, where they blow up the fleet with the green wildfire.
There we go. So that's what I thought of when I when it says with a roar the fire turned emerald green and rose higher. So that's what I thought of. So there was a little Game of Thrones throw in.
Yeah. But Harry, because of his nerves and his mouth is full of soot, he does not enunciate properly, and he does not end up in Diagon Alley. He ends up in this raggedy-ass place known as Borgin and Burt.
AKA the scary part of, like, wizard shopping. That's what I would say this place is.
Yes. What did you think when describing all the things that were in this shop?
Well, I mean, okay, we didn't see the spiders here, but this was very kind of classic witch and wizard stuff pre, you know, I think feel like pre-modernization. Like, this is the stereotype of what people often think of when you talk about, like, witchcraft and things like that. I think less so now because there's been kind of a movement toward different things, but, you know, back in the day, all of the things here kind of exemplified witchy, wizardy, scary Halloween kind
of things. Yeah, to me, it's not even like the actual, like, you know, because the oldest, like, I've seen pictures of the oldest occult store in New York City. It's not this spooky either. Like, this is a caricature of all the things that people thought witches and wizards were all about in, like, the 16th, 17th century.
Exactly. Yeah, this is very... I can't think of the word right now, but Malfoy's looking at a shelf full of skulls. I mean, that doesn't sound like a very warm and fuzzy place to be.
Yeah, so Harry, you know, tries to get out, but before he can sneak out, he sees the Malfoys, both father and son, and Harry has to duck into a wardrobe. What did you think of the interaction between Draco and his father?
I don't really know what to think about these two, because... Malfoy's a brat. Draco is a brat. And his dad, and it didn't seem like it was ever, he was ever really bothered by it. Here's my honest takeaway from when I read this. The father seemed like less of a dick. And I was like kind of a little confused by that. And I think he calls him out with kind of his obsession with Harry Potter too, which I thought was kind of...
Yeah, well, I think... Malfoy is at a point, or like Mr. Lucius Malfoy, is a point where he's better at hiding his, like, contempt for other people. Or if not hiding it, at least, like, not opening his mouth and spewing crap like Draco does.
Right. I guess a little age on there. helps.
Yeah.
Helps.
So again, just that normal maturation of we all realize that if we keep shooting our mouth off, not the best thing happens. And so as we get older, we get less and less precocious.
I'm still learning that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. What I found interesting is, again, Draco's going on and on. Harry Potter got a Nimbus 2000. Everyone thinks he's great, you know, because he has that stupid scar on his forehead. And it goes back to what I think Kevin and Amanda were talking about, the whole idea that Draco cannot stand that Harry is disrupting the natural order of things in terms of socioeconomic class, that this upstarter has the celebrity that he has.
Yeah, that is very offensive, especially to this family that is kind of used to having a certain status and being looked at versus looked away from. I think, you know, if Harry and Malfoy walked into a room, Harry's obviously going to get the attention that Draco may have had Harry not been there. So, I mean, you would like to just tell him to get over it and move on, but that's not going to, that would change the dynamic of the story. So we're not going to do that. But it is pretty interesting that his, you know, obsession with Harry did kind of, he's talking about him when he's not even there, which is kind of, you know, the thing that.
Which is why there's so many Draco Harry fanfics.
How romantic, I guess. Whatever, I don't know.
And then Draco goes off on Hermione, and his father's like, I would assume you would be embarrassed that a girl of no wizarding family had beat you at every subject. To what I was saying a few episodes ago, that again, in my headcanon, Draco is almost on par intellectually with Hermione, and that's why he hones in on her a lot and resents her a lot.
That makes sense. And then I guess just, you know, some old school sexism. It's like a girl's doing better than you. Oh my God, you know.
It's just the dynamic of sexism. I'm pretty sure sexism would still exist in a wizarding society, but it's just the idea that with magic, you're taking away the advantage of like physical strength.
Yeah, that is interesting. It kind of puts everybody on the same level.
Yeah, so like theoretically it does physically put everyone on the same level, but at the same time I still think it's true that sexism would prevail, because if they're not mocking the physical weakness, the patriarchy would be mocking what they perceive to be as women's mental weakness.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hermione's proving him wrong there.
Yeah. But Mr. Malfoy is specifically in Borgin and Burks is he's got to dump a lot of shit so he doesn't get in trouble.
Right. Right.
Which trying to flush drugs down the toilet.
Yeah. Which is so interesting, because I think Harry now knows the level at which, you know, this is an issue within the wizarding world because mm-hmm. of living with the Weasleys and knowing what Arthur is tasked with. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and it's like, surely, you know, you haven't been bothered, Mr. Malfoy. You know, the Malfoy name still commands some respect, but there have been more raids lately, and no thanks to that flea-bitten Mr. Weasley. And yeah.
Ugh, you can just go away.
You know, from what we see also later in this chapter, it is also my headcanon that basically Arthur and Lucius hated each other exactly the same way that Draco and Harry hate each other.
That makes sense. That makes sense also.
Very old, old rivalry.
Also kind of two completely different life ideologies. That's not really what I was looking for, but they're definitely at the opposite end of the spectrum on these things.
Lucius is able to conduct his business and they leave, and Harry is finally able to escape. And so I think I remember me mentioning Diagon Alley in our Sublimely Gothic, you know, Gothic and Harry Potter episode.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Nocturne Alley, basically, especially on the outside in the street, makes me think of that old, dark, dreary, wet, Dixonian type of London.
Yeah, it's exactly what I thought of, too. It definitely, he's going past these places and there's a window display of shrunken heads, a large cage with alive gigantic spiders, which I love, and
poison candles.
Yeah, this is just like it also reminds me of like Sweeney Todd, like that kind of London vibe. That's yeah. The vibe.
And Harry is accosted by a crone, but who comes to the rescue but Hagrid.
Good old Hagrid looking for some slugs, some flesh-eating slugs.
It's like, why are you doing Nocturnally? What are you doing here?
Right, right.
Like when you see a coworker be where they shouldn't be, but then why are you there?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, that's, well, I feel like here, I mean, Hagrid was pretty ready with that. I'm getting some slug repellent. The, you know, they're out of control. It's like, okay, yeah, you probably wouldn't find that in Diagon Alley. That sounds pretty intense.
True. But luckily, Hagrid escorts Harry back to the Weasleys and to Hermione as well. And I would just say, I'm really sad we didn't get more of Hermione's parents.
Yeah, yeah, Arthur is very fascinated by her parents, which I think is kind of cute. But I also like how she just kind of like comes right out at him with what happened to your glasses. It's just like no time has been lost with them.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if Hermione's parents, if there's a single word of dialogue within this whole series.
Oh, that's
that they utter. So yeah, I know this from Harry's perspective and whatnot, but it just would have been nice to, you know, hear the perspective of Muggles that weren't complete trash like the Dursleys, and about, you know, having a wizard, a witch daughter.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe throw some dentistry in there. Right. They're dentists. Right. So
right.
There we go. No, I agree. It would be nice to kind of get to know them, because maybe we would get to know more about Hermione and kind of why she is the way she is.
Yeah. But they all go to the bank to get, you know, withdraw from their vaults. And okay, I wanted to get your thoughts. You touched upon it a little bit, but some parts of the fandom really criticize Harry for not doing more financially for the Weasleys. I tend to be more in the camp that Harry is a kid and naturally does not have the nuance or subtlety to navigate that type of situation.
I think I'm on your side. You know, I kind of said that, but then I also kind of, I'm glad you mentioned, it's so easy for me to forget that he's a kid. And I also think as a kid, he realizes like he does have money, but I don't know if he really understands fully how much he has. He knows he has a lot, but comparatively. And, you know, what would be helpful to the Weasleys and what wouldn't. He probably just doesn't really know, I'm guessing, yet. But I still kind of felt like a bit of like awkwardness through this whole part when they were going to get their money. And he's aware enough that he's trying to like hide it from them. I don't know. It's hard to say. And especially it's hard for me to know, you know, how much he relies on the Weasleys. I mean, it would be nice to think he would be like, I don't know, mature enough to be like, here's some money for rent or something like that. You know, why I stayed with you. But I don't know. I'm really interested to see how this plays out through the series, knowing that he does have so much money that he could probably afford to throw some of the Weasleys away.
And he does later on, you know, with the books and Ginny. But first, you know, they peruse Diagon Alley on their own, promising Molly Weasley to meet at the bookstore in an hour. And so they decide, the three of them decide to go get ice cream. What was it? Strawberry and peanut butter sundaes?
Yeah, which sounds pretty interesting.
That sounds so delicious, and it makes me so jealous, because even if such a thing exists, I could not eat it because I'm allergic to strawberries.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Well, maybe they'll make a raspberry one for
you. Peanut butter jelly sandwich. I think PB&J was what they're trying to go for with this sundae.
Sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. But they do end up at the bookshop, and also the bookshop Flourish and Blots is the name of our book club if you are a Ravenclaw patron on Patreon, so make sure to go check that out.
Yes, please.
And so, yeah, it's all crowded because Gilderoy Lockhart is giving a book signing. And do you remember who plays Gilderoy Lockhart in the movie?
I can see. Is it? Oh my gosh. It's not Eddie Izzard, is it?
No.
Okay, I can see his face in my mind's eye, but I don't know the actor.
Kenneth Branagh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And you know, interesting. You know, the guy who loves Shakespeare so much?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying he was bad at that role. I think what he did in sort of his presence kind of made up for the fact that he's not like, you know, they describe him as being like, you know, devilishly handsome. If they ever do a remake of Harry Potter, be it another set of movies or a TV show, you know who I want Gilderoy Lockhart to be?
Please, please don't.
Orlando Bloom.
Oh, yeah, that would be good.
I feel like he has the range to use his good looks, but also be comical.
Yeah, he could do that pretty well. And it's funny that you say this, because I remember the actor, you know, just kind of like flashing in my mind. And I was like, I didn't think he was anything to write home about. But apparently all these ladies did. So that's fine. But I think that's a great...
It wasn't so much about his looks. It was much more like what built him up as Gilderoy Lockhart was, again, just his prestige within the industry.
Okay, yeah.
He's done so much like Shakespeare adaptations and other things like that.
Yeah. That's interesting. I'm a Doctor Who fan, so when David Tennant shows up, I forgot the character he plays, but I'm excited to get to him.
Yep. Yeah, so at the bookshop, they meet Gilderoy Lockhart, who is basically narcissism personified.
He definitely is, and he's super excited that Harry Potter is there so he can take a picture with him. And,
yeah, you and me are worth the front page.
Right, exactly. But then Malfoy is of course there and is pissed off about that, and then makes fun of poor Jenny, who I felt bad for. He said, "Potter, you've got yourself a girlfriend," and then Jenny went scarlet as Ron and Hermione fought their way over, both clutching stacks of Lockhart's. But poor Jenny, she's just trying to live.
Again, for all the critics of Harry, like, the minute that Harry doesn't has a bit of a private moment to himself with Jenny, he does surreptitious, like, here, take my own.
Yes.
So I think it's a part of he wants to help. And throughout the books, he will help the Weasleys, but I feel like maybe in more subtle ways. Like, he doesn't want to, like, embarrass them by openly offering stuff, especially to, like, adults like Molly and Arthur.
Yeah, and especially, I guess, in front of when you have people like Draco. I mean, that's just kind of got to be really awkward and uncomfortable. So I'm sure Harry's going about it the way
in a good way. You know, again, depending on the level of pride that Arthur and Molly have, I think it could be safe to say that, you know, even if Arthur and Molly wouldn't take anything directly from Harry, like, they care enough about, like, Ginny, the youngest and their only daughter, that they would allow Harry to, like, indulge her.
Yeah, which this I'm thinking of way down the line. I know a little bit about what transpires with Harry and Jenny, and I'm just thinking about that since we're talking about how that will work. But anyway, we're not there yet. That's a ways away.
Okay. Ron decides to go for Draco because, again, Draco's just spewing, you know, I'm wealthy, you're not. And Arthur's like, what's going on? And then the same thing just between Arthur and Lucius.
Which I think is a testament to your thought that this is like a rivalry for generations. So, goodness, I can't imagine two grown men fighting in a bookstore. Like, how embarrassing for everyone. Like,
yeah, I remember is my mom threw a Karen moment in our local Barnes & Noble ones. And I can't even say, I don't remember what the problem was, so I don't even know if she was justified or not. But yeah, I remember that was just, because bookstores are like libraries. Shh.
Right. Let's all just like, well, I guess it would be really exciting. I have a friend that's worked at a few like pretty interesting bookstores. She worked at Poetry and Prose in DC, so I'll have to ask her if there were ever any grown men brawling in the store.
Yeah, and it ends up being Hagrid who has to pull them apart.
What a good person to break up a fight. Like, if you need somebody to break up a fight, Hagrid would be the person that...
And again, and what does it say about Hagrid that, again, everyone assumes maybe the worst of him because of his sheer size and stature, but he's, like, one of the more pacifist, more emotionally intuned of certain male characters in this story.
I love that. I love that about him. He reminds me of some guys I worked with back in the day that kind of looked like one particular person comes very much to mind, who was basically a Hagrid, but basically just like a big teddy bear. So always have a place in my heart, Mr. Hagrid.
Yeah, I remember when I used to binge watch, what was it? Cupcake Wars. It was one of those cooking competitions specifically geared towards cupcakes. And I remember some of the contestants literally being these huge muscular men with tattoos all across their arms. And again, if they weren't cooking cupcakes, you would probably see them at a monster truck rally.
The guys I was talking about were all metalheads, but they were like the sweetest people. Same.
Yeah, like, so look. I was just like, you know, you better not be dissing on this guy's cupcakes. But anyway, again, I appreciate that in Hagrid as well.
I do too.
Lucius is like, here, take your book, girl. It's the best you're father can give you. And first of all, what the hell is wrong with you's books? Shame on you, Lucius Malfoy.
What a dick. It's obvious where Draco learned some of his moves. But like I said, like right now, I think you made a good point. Draco can hide it a little bit. Lucius can hide it a little bit more than Draco, but yeah. Get out of here, Malfoys. I don't like them.
I hate the whole, like, snobbery around secondhand stuff because, you know, my husband and I are notorious thrifters.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Like, we know how to shop at Goodwill and stuff and know how to look for really nice brands that show up.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Like, I've gotten a variety of, like, you know, nice dresses and other pieces of clothing, you know, my husband too, sometimes silk, sometimes whatever. And I just hate the perception that if you dress well, you automatically must be rich and therefore you automatically must be a snob.
No, yeah, not at all.
No, you don't have to. Get your ass in a Goodwill and it just takes a little like thought put through
it. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Time.
Yeah. But again, assholes like the Malfoys perpetuate this, oh, having the best thing and never having anything secondhand. And yeah, just, I don't know. When it comes to books used and new, like, I'm all over the place where, like, there are some books that I want brand new just to have for me for prosperity. Like, again, investing in the fancy illustrated editions of Game of Thrones that.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, I also have a really battered old poetry book from 1917. And I think that's, you know, it's a historical item to me.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think collecting things, books and everything. Goodness, there's I talked about this, Pretend It's a City, the show with, oh my gosh, I am like losing my mind. But anyway, she has collected, I don't know how many thousands upon thousands of books. And she has like the first book that she ever got. And I can't think of her name because I'm brain dead right now. But anyway, so I think everybody's got to collect something or have an interest in something, and there's nothing wrong with it. Sometimes you might find a letter from, like a weird letter or something. Some people find money in books. So if goodness, I feel like why not secondhand their Malfoy, you know, if you're like into money.
Yeah, Lucius Malfoy's transgressions, I think book shaming is the worst.
I think it is a very bad trait as well.
Yeah. Although I will admit that Lucius Malfoy is one of my favorite minor villains in the series.
Oh, really? Okay. I'm excited to know more about
him. I love the way that Jason Isaac plays him in the movies.
That actor is pretty iconic. I mean, I can see that character in my head from what I've seen of you. So
yeah, because he did his part so well. That it's not in the book at all, but you know, like in the movies, he has his like pimp cane with the snake head on it.
Yes, yeah.
And in the cane is his wand.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
He hides his cane in his wand. And that's just become, even though it's technically not in the books, that's just so associated with him now.
That's, I like that little nuance. That's,
yep. And of course, Molly's like a fine example to set for your children, brawling in public, what Gilderoy Lockhart must have thought.
Yes, because that is what matters. Molly is what Gilderoy Lockhart, I guess, you know, the fact that he's teaching the kids, maybe that's okay bad. To punch. Right.
Yeah.
But then they're off to, then they're back to the house, and Harry took off his glasses so they wouldn't break again, because that happened. And then he said it definitely wasn't his favorite way to travel. Understandable. He had a weird experience. With the flu.
And that concludes chapter 4. So, shall we move to Gothic Geek Out?
Yeah, I feel like this one's pretty easy for the Gothic Geek.
Yep, Nocturne Alley.
Exactly. That's exactly the way where I was going to go as well. Man, and I think we talked about it enough, just like the details of it, just kind of stereotypically Gothic elements, the skulls, the spiders, I loved the description of the oily voiced person, the oily voiced man. Yeah, I just thought that was such an interesting way to describe somebody and somebody's voice.
So spineless and contemptuous, because the minute Malfoy leaves, he's just like, oh, I know you've got shit in your manner, like, that I could only, like, dream about.
Right, yeah. That guy's not nice, but... Was there any other element of gothicness that you observed? Because that was really all of mine.
My only was just the Malfoys themselves as representing that family of old money and just demonstrating in the society that classism still exists, and that classism was a big chunk of what Gothic literature was often criticizing, or at the very least, commentating on.
That's a great point. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And again, I think Lucius Malfoy himself exemplifies that very aloof, you know, patriarch of such a family.
Yeah, yeah, he does. He seems like he could just fit right into a Gothic novel pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. We will see Malfoy Manor later on, but...
Oh, okay, cool.
But anyway, but that is not for quite some time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, and then we can move on to Tarot of the Day.
Yes, very exciting.
So I'm shuffling. If doing this podcast will take 2 years, so technically we will run out of tarot cards eventually because there are 78. So after that, we'll have to move into oracle cards.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, but okay. Let's see. The one I picked is the Lovers of all things.
Really? Okay.
We have card number 6 from the Major Arcana, the Lovers. Okay.
I was going to say, you did mention some of the fanfic with Draco and Harry. That's fine. I guess maybe that's what it was picking up on. Like I said, the thing I know about Harry and Jenny. So
here, let's see. Good definition. Okay. In its purest form, the Lovers card represents conscious connections and meaningful relationships. The arrival of this card in a tarot reading shows that you have a beautiful, soul-honoring connection with a loved one. You may believe you have found your soulmate or life partner, and the sexual energy between you both goes way beyond instant gratification and lusts for something that is very spiritual and almost tantric. While the Lovers card typically refers to a romantic tie, it can also represent a close friendship or family relationship where love, respect, and compassion flow. Okay, so Harry being adopted into the Weasley family, more or less.
Exactly. That's exactly what I think 100%, because that's all the things that were missing from his life 5 are now embodied by the Dursleys, and we're all very happy that that has occurred. So that's a great card for this chapter. These chapters.
It seems kind of screwy, but again, you know, because there are a lot of cards that, you know, of course it has a very direct meaning, but also it's not just that. Like, death card isn't just death, it's transformation, it's purging, and all sorts of other things like that. Likewise with the Lovers, it's, you know, the Greeks, you know, divided, Eros and Agape and all the other types of loves.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. I think it's a great card. I'm glad it was.
Yeah. So, yeah, love, family love, Weasley's bringing Harry and family. Close relationship, a friendship with Ron and Harry.
Yeah, I guess like you said, to look at it like traditionally with the Lovers card, and you think of romantic love, but the familial love is really exemplified, and Harry definitely feels that in when he's at their home. He kind of, I think their home, like we talked about, even kind of in aesthetic, that you can tell that it is well loved, and there is a lot kindness and respect for each other. I mean, I guess you could argue with the twins that they're kind of ornery to the family, but that's okay.
And also one more thing. On a more personal level, the Lovers card represents getting clear about your values and beliefs. You are figuring out what you stand for and your philosophy. So for me, that what's also relevant in this chapter of we get the very stark belief systems exemplified by the opposite ends of the spectrum, the Weasleys and the Malfoys.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
So again, what Fred and George would say is that apparently Lucius Malfoy did lots of really bad things during Voldemort's like first reign of power. But when Voldemort was gone, he claims that he was like he was enchanted, he was bewitched, he didn't mean to do any of it. And clearly it was believed enough where he's now roaming society unhindered.
Right. Yeah. That's a relationship that I am curious about, the kind of ins and outs of the Malfoys and Voldemort. And
yeah. Like I thought I felt bad. Like when we were talking to Amanda and Kevin, like with Draco, and I felt like, oh, did I spill too much about Draco's dad in the episode, but it's like, you know, the fact that he has dark objects in his house that he's trying to flush down the toilet. I was just like, I'm not giving anything away that this is an asshole or a bad dude.
No, no. And also my memory is like 5 seconds long right now. So I wouldn't, it's all good. I think that, I can tell this family is not not a very kind family. Do we meet his mom? Like Draco's mother?
We do not see Draco's mom until book 4.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Cause she hasn't been, I don't think there's been much mention of her. I imagine she has, you know, like icy blonde hair like the rest of them, but I don't know.
Yeah. The one thing I will say is that, you know, through like, again, Pottermore and other geeky Harry Potter stuff is that even amongst these pure blood wizards, these pure blood families, the Malfoys are especially patriarchal.
Okay.
Even more so than some of the other families who hold these supremacist beliefs.
So they're like old school, old school, old school.
Yeah. So, alrighty then. Yeah, I was worried about that card, but yeah. And again, pure romance is, again, you said, you know, Harry and Ginny get together.
Yes, I feel like that's always just, I'm a romantic, so I always have to like figure out what's happening there. And I knew that's coming. I know about those two big, like, the pairings that happen at the end, because I think they were such a big deal. They happen. Mm-hmm. So.
Alrighty then. And now we move on to fan fiction time.
Oh gosh.
It was hard for me to come up with one this time.
I guess, you know, kind of the only thing that I could think of is what if Harry just ended up where he needed to be? Like in Diagon Alley, he didn't overhear any of those conversations. He just kind of was oblivious to that. I mean, that wouldn't make it as much fun to have those kind of insights, but that was kind of the extent of my what if.
Yeah, because the confrontation with the at the bookstore would have happened either way.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see kind of the absolutely. I mean, those two each other, that because nobody, Harry, they don't know Harry was there. They don't know he has this knowledge that he does.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I had.
Yeah, mine was what if Lucius and Draco had seen Harry in the shop?
Ooh, I feel like it would not have ended well for Harry.
Especially because it's not like, and it also depends on when they would discovered Harry being there. Because if they had just like opened the door immediately and saw Harry there, like clearly Malfoy is there to do some shady business. So they probably just would have exchanged petty words and left. But I'm thinking the more interesting question is, what if they had found Harry in the middle of this conversation and Lucius realizes that a kid now knows that he's trying to get rid of stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was going to say, like, is that part of the wizarding world? Like, is that like would you expect, like, I feel like you would expect the Malfoys to be there, but you wouldn't expect, like, Hagrid is surprised Harry is there.
Yeah. Well, is it a place that Nocturne Alley is affiliated with the Dark Arts? And so certainly Harry being the quote unquote Jesus Christ figure, what the hell is he doing in with the Dark Arts stuff?
Yeah. So the Malfoys, it's kind of like, okay, they would be there. Not a big deal. But because I think that would be something that might be used against Harry as well. The Malfoys could be like, well, you'll never guess where we saw Mr. Harry Potter. Because they could say that because they're like, well, of course they're going to be there because they're, you know, dark arts people or like whatever. But yeah, what if Harry like blew his cover or kind of mid sentence was like popped out of the little cabinet and was like, haha. I heard everything you said. I don't know.
Honestly, compared to other characters, again, which is why I like Lucius Malfoy, is again, he's much more subdued. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, certainly he's not going to, if he found out Harry knew stuff, he's not going to kidnap him or do something crazy. But I think he would have, like, erased his memory.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Because there is a spell that does that.
Okay. I was going to say, I didn't know they could do that, but now I do.
They can do that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think that would have most likely happened because it would not be in Lucius Malfoy's interest to be anyway linked with, oh, Harry Potter is missing. Where was he last seen? Oh, he was in Borgin and Burt's with the Malfoys.
Yeah. I feel like that memory spell is done on me almost nightly these days. Anyway, yep. Interesting.
Alrighty then, and that concludes the third and fourth chapters of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Tune in next week and we will be going over chapter 5, The Whomping Willow, and chapter 6, Gilderoy Lockhart. Catch you guys later.
Bye.